From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruiak. The California wildfire fight continues today. The Mendocino complex fires flared up overnight, but the Carr fire near Redding continues to be moving in its containment. At about 9:30 today, we'll get an update from CAL FIRE Chief Mike Moeller. Meanwhile, the actual cost of fighting wildfires has been in focus at the state capitol. It's also a subject the PolitiFact California team has been researching. And in the studio with me is PolitiFact reporter Chris Nichols. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Beth. Glad to have you here. Thank you.
And the team's intern, Sammy Soto. Hi, Sammy.
Hi, Beth.
Glad to have you back. And Chris, what prompted your team to take a look at the facts and figures?
Well, we've been seeing and hearing this real devastation, of course, across our state in Redding, Mendocino County, Southern California, from these wildfires. And I think that has been made dramatically clear. But what we're also noticing now that we've had a few days and weeks to look at this is that the cost of these fires is also dramatically going up. We wanted to know how much it's added up to, how much it's changed over time as we've seen more and more of these huge infernos spread across our state in recent years.
Firefighting is a budget item, Sammy, so let's start there. Tell me about the budget that the state allocates.
So CAL FIRE wildfire spending costs, they have increased drastically over these past 4 years. They've gone from $242 million to $534 million in spending. And, you know, as fire seasons are on average 75 days longer now than they were 4 years ago, it's just continuing to increase the spending costs for fires. And the state puts away reserve funds for emergencies called the Emergency Fund for floods, for fires, and wildfire costs have gone over this emergency fund budget in the past 7 of the last 10 years. And in this fiscal year, which actually just started in July, on July 1st, firefighting costs are already around $114 million. And for the annual fund overall for this year, it's the emergency fund is budgeted for $442 million. And so if you kind of look at that $114 million that's already been spent compared to what the overall $442 million in the budget, that's about 1/4 of the emergency fund for firefighting that's already been spent.
To me, there are a couple takeaways from those numbers. One is going from $242 million to $534 million is phenomenal. But even that said, we're exceeding the spending every year compared to what the budget item is. And then on top of it, this is phenomenal. You think about $500,000 for or $500 million for firefighting, and yet the fires last year did $10 billion, $12 billion in damages. So is there a disconnect here? Is there a break in the budgeting and the allocation of funds?
Well, every year the state government is putting more and more money into these funds to fight wildfires. And the federal government actually relieves some of these costs for the state. But according to a spokesperson for the governor's office of emergency services, it's kind of too early in this fire season, at least, to tell how these costs are going to be managed between the state and the federal governments.
So there is a sort of choreography that occurs between the two. And as I've talked with Ben Adler, the FEMA funds come in for emergency times, and then we get into the long-range planning. Did any of this surprise you, Sammy, as you and the team talked about these numbers? And Chris, you can chime in here, too. Was this different than what you expected?
Well, I think it's just a dramatic increase, and it makes you wonder, as we see more and more of these fires, where will these numbers be just in a few years? It doesn't seem like these fires are getting smaller or less frequent. It seems like just the opposite. And then it also makes you wonder, what if we're spending this much, understandably, to fight these fires, what can we not spend on? What are the consequences? Certainly, whether it's the federal government or the state, it's all taxpayer money. And, you know, it's a lot of money to spend on this. Are we losing out on education programs or fire suppression, thinning our forests because we have to fight these giant infernos.
And I guess that is the bigger question is, do we just deal with the pot of money as it is and some of the allocation gets moved around, or do we need a new and different funding source to be able to add more to the firefighting funding? Yeah. All right. Well, Sammy, thank you. That's not a typical fact check. So how is that information going to be published?
Right now, we're kind of just continuing to gather these figures and facts. And we want to be able to publish this because it is really interesting. And these numbers can get really confusing really fast for people.
We're looking at potentially putting an article together for later this week.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. Now let's move on to a PolitiFact article that is going to be published later today, I believe. It looks at a claim by California Congressman Tom McClintock regarding the sanctuary state law. Chris, do you want to set us up for that one?
Sure. Congressman McClintock represents the 4th Congressional District east of Sacramento. And the reason we are taking a look at him is last week we did a fact check on his challenger in that race, Jessica Morse. So this week we are taking a look at some of his statements, including on the sanctuary state law. And the statement in particular comes from a letter he wrote earlier this month where he said that California has a policy of releasing dangerous criminal illegal aliens back into our communities rather than remanding them to federal authorities for deportation.
A little bit of background. SB 54, known as the California Values Act, was signed last year by our governor, Jerry Brown. And there's been a lot of confusion, shall I say, controversy and mischaracterization of what this law is.
I think we've really seen a real pattern of mischaracterizing this law in particular. I think, you know, a lot of laws or policies are mischaracterized or maybe selectively presented by politicians. But this one seems to stand out, not just in California, but nationwide. Republicans across the country, including President Trump, have heavily criticized this law, and they really don't always present the full picture of what's going on with it, what is allowed when it comes to cooperation by local law enforcement with federal immigration authorities, which is really at the heart of this law. There are restrictions on that, there's no doubt. But as I know, we have a clip from UC Irvine political science professor Louis DeCipio. He talks about how politicians will really only tell you part of what is going on depending on the audience they're speaking to.
There's a segment of the state who would advocate not having sanctuary policies. Elected officials who are trying to, you know, to win the votes of those communities or to speak to those communities are going to sort of highlight the fact that the state has, in fact, defined a bunch of offenses for which there will not be cooperation with ICE, and that, you know, that's probably troubling to some in the state. But the other side of that coin is that the legislature has deliberated and determined that there are a range of offenses for which people should not be subject to state cooperation in their deportation.
One of his points is important in this, and that is, who was Congressman McClintock addressing when he made his comments? Because the professor's suggestion is that he's going to color them or change them depending on who he's talking to. He is a Republican congressman from a heavily Republican district. I believe that he was in some dialogue with the Placer County Board of Supervisors in the context of this claim.
That's right. He was writing a letter to the Placer County Board of Supervisors earlier this month urging them to essentially condemn the state law, as some cities and counties, more than a dozen across California, have done. They've taken a stand against the law. Ultimately, the Placer County Board of Supervisors decided not to do that. But that was his audience. It was a letter to the supervisors. So I think, yes, in that particular audience, he described it one way. And I think it's also important when you hear him describe this as essentially a policy of releasing dangerous criminals, it's important to understand what the law does and does not do, if we have a moment to get into that, I think it is clear that the law prohibits cooperation with our local police, our local sheriffs, working with federal immigration authorities when it comes to many of the lesser crimes, typically misdemeanor crimes. But I think when you look at, for example, the signing message that Governor Jerry Brown wrote when he signed this into law last fall, I think his words really clarify what is still allowed. He said, quote, "The bill does not prohibit sheriffs from granting immigration authorities access to California jails to conduct routine interviews, nor does it prevent cooperation in deportation proceedings for anyone in state prison or for those in local jails for any of the hundreds of serious offenses listed in the Trust Act." And that's a piece of legislation signed a few years back.
And yet the California State Sheriff's Association did oppose SB 54.
They did, and they still have some concerns. It is a state law now, and I spoke with a representative from the Sheriff's Association, Corey Salzillo. He told me sheriffs have no interest in being in any way frontline immigration agents, but they do have concerns because some of these crimes or offenses that one technically might be considered lesser crimes or misdemeanors and not rise to that technical level of serious or violent are still concerning. Things like some cases of domestic battery, some cases of assault on a peace officer, animal cruelty. And I know we have a clip of him talking a little bit about this.
Serious and violent felony are defined in the penal code in California. So there are crimes that you or I might think are serious and or violent that may not be serious and or violent according to statute.
With that, let's go back to, again, the claim that Tom McClintock made, and that was that California has, quote, "a policy of releasing dangerous criminal illegal aliens back into our communities rather than remanding them to federal authorities for deportation." What did McClintock's office say when you contacted them about the fact check?
Well, they pointed to quite a few statements from law enforcement, including like the statements that Corey Salzillo made, that sheriffs across the 4th Congressional District have made with their concerns, the idea that they want to be able to keep their communities safe, and they feel if undocumented residents who have committed these crimes, if they cannot cooperate with federal immigration agents, that means many of these people are sent back to communities, and there's no coordination in working to essentially deport them. That is concerning in many cases for them. But at the end of the day, when we looked at the particular statement made by Congressman McClintock, it leaves quite a bit out. It really does not tell you about all of these serious and violent offenses where local law enforcement still can partner with the immigration authorities, as Governor Brown laid out in his signing message. So I think that at best, it's sort of a deeply incomplete statement. But there was a part of it that is pretty complicated or sort of leaves us unable to place a formal rating on this. When you talk about dangerous criminals, which is the word that the congressman used, That's really a judgment. It's an opinion. We can't place a rating on a statement when it's a judgment call. So we can only lay out the facts and talk about what is included, what the congressman did include, what he left out. But we did find at the end that, and we'll detail this in an article we publish later today, that the majority of the facts really don't support this particular viewpoint. But again, it's not one that we placed a rating on.
Okay. And because you referenced the claim that was researched by his challenger, Jessica Morse, let's just quickly review that. That claim originated with something that Jessica Morse posted on Twitter. She wrote that GOP Representative Tom McClintock, quote, "has authored three laws since he's been in office, two renamed post offices."
That's right. And part of that statement including a description about McClintock as being essentially utterly ineffective in Congress. So she's tying together the idea that three laws, two of them renaming post offices, which are correct, leads to essentially an utterly ineffective congressman. We found online that, you know, McClintock has authored four bills to were to rename post offices. But more than just being slightly off on this number, her statement is misleading because members of Congress rarely author standalone bills. Most are added as amendments to larger bills. Many longtime members of Congress have only authored a handful of standalone bills. And in addition, the number of bills authored, it's just not necessarily the best measurement of a politician's effectiveness. There's many, many other ways they can shape legislation. So in the end, with that statement, we rated Morse's statement false.
That one is already up online. The McClintock article goes up this afternoon. And Sammy, you said maybe by the end of the week, more on the wildfire research.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So thank you both for all your work. Thanks for joining us today. I always look forward to you being here with us on Insight.
Thank you, Beth.
Thanks, Beth.
That is Chris Nichols and Sammy Soto. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio.